I'm Jay Newby. I am an associate professor at the University of Alberta. I study math biology.
And I am Pamvi Bahia. I am a neuroscientist, communicator, and your host of Biology in Numbers, a podcast by the Society for Mathematical Biology, aka SMB, if you're into the acronyms. So how's life treating you, Jay?
Life is good. I've been on sabbatical this year, so life is very good. Busy, but yeah, I'm having a great summer.
Nice. Certainly can't complain about sabbaticals.
No.
So while this is a podcast about essentially marrying together the subjects of mathematics and biology, if you had to stay friends with one of them after the divorce, would it be the subject of math or biology?
Oh, man, that's a tough one. It makes me think more of like the kids trying to pick which parent to go live with. I love them both, so I don't know if I could. That would be a terrible decision to have to make.
Okay, well, we'll just put you as team both.
Yeah, team both. I'm an interdisciplinary scientist, I like to think. And so I don't think I would be happy, you know, studying pure math problems or just sitting in a lab, you know, with my pipette. And I'm too clumsy. I don't have the hand dexterity, I don't think, to really be successful with experiments either.
That's fair. I think my husband would empathize with you on that. So the other reason why we're recording this podcast is because it's to essentially honor the SMB. So as a member, can you tell us what the Society means to you?
Yeah. So the Society for me has been mostly about the conferences. And they're really great conferences because every single one of them is organized by volunteers. And they're organized all over the world. It's a North American focused, like maybe the majority of the membership. That allows me to go to a lot of the meetings because they're going to be kind of local. But at the same time, I have the opportunity to go abroad. We were just in Korea. And every time they're organized, the organizers reinvent it from scratch. And so there's this amazing variety. You never know quite what, you know, you're going to get. So the alternative, I think, is SIAM meetings, which are, they're great too, but they have a staff and it's a well-oiled machine. So you really know what you're going to get when you go to a SIAM meeting, right? That's what it means to me, I guess. But I know there's much more to the Society than just the meetings, I have to say. So
yeah
I don't want to shortchange everything that the Society does.
No, absolutely. So for the uninitiated among us, can you explain what SIAM is?
Yes, the Society for Industrial Applied Mathematics. So the scope is much broader than SMB, which focuses just on math biology. And they put on a number of conferences every year. So they've got, you know, a bigger budget. They've got permanent staff. Yeah. So usually the conferences that I go to are a combination of like SIAM and SMB.
Okay. And I think actually you've touched upon something that we've never really focused on, which is that SMB is entirely volunteer run, which to me, as someone who's been a member of enormous societies as a biologist, that is quite overwhelming.
I'm constantly impressed. As a mathematician, I know that we have a culture of DIY. We do so much ourselves. I think that's kind of because, you know, we have this versatile set of skills, computer programming, that allows us to do stuff ourselves. But to actually execute this, to actually make it work, to see how resourceful people are, yeah, it's impressive.
It is very impressive. You started to sound a bit Liam Neeson there with a unique set of skills.
Well, that's resourceful in a different way.
But you actually created a very nice segue for me in the sense that I am going to ask you about the meeting now. So last year, I had the pleasure of finding out from Yangjin Kim about some of the things that the attendees could look forward to when they were going to Seoul. So how is Edmonton going to rival that? And I suppose we should have started out by saying that you are one of the conference organizers this year, right?
I am. Yes, I'm organizing the annual meeting. I think that I said yes, because just how much fun, how amazing, how inspiring the last meeting was. So it was in Seoul in 2024. It was a really great meeting, and it's really daunting to have to follow that. So, I mean, they specifically told me that I'm paraphrasing, but you need to make it as good as this. Well, Edmonton is the city in North America that no one has ever heard of. I think Seth Rogen even made a joke about it in a movie. I don't remember which one. He said, I'm from Edmonton. You've probably never heard of it. It's the northernmost city in Canada, a major city. There's a couple of million people here. And to answer your question, how do I think I'm going to measure up to the Seoul meeting? I don't know. But Edmonton is beautiful in the summer. Anybody who likes doing anything outdoors, hiking, cycling, especially cycling, that's my personal favorite. We have a park system that is really special. We just refer to it as the River Valley. It's actually a big connected set of parks that are organized just around the river. And they've been slowly constructed and put together over like 100 years. This is something that the city has been working on for generations. And it's really special. It's really impressive.
Nice. So, as someone who really enjoys trail running, you've already won me over outside the kind of the more social aspects, because I'm sure you're going to have all of those fun kind of events that bring all the scientists together. What are some of the things that you're looking forward to on the itinerary from a more scientific point of view?
Oh, for the meeting, I can't wait to hear all the talks from the award winners, the plenary speakers that we were very fortunate to be able to line up. Some great speakers lined up. I think this year we have a number of speakers who are going to focus on cancer research. So that will be a big topic this year. What else? We made a major effort to just get as many what we call mini symposia. So they're like four related 25-minute talks on a certain topic, and we're going to have 15 of these running at the same time. So we try to have a really great cross-section of topics, try to focus on getting people from areas that haven't historically been as represented in SMB, like neuroscience. And we have a new subgroup, we always just call it PKPD,
We
to the
can throw back
people.
to Marissa's episode.
Right. I listened to that. That was very good. Yes, so this is a really exciting area of research. It has a huge impact. And so there's a new subgroup on that now. That's very cool. Yeah, I guess I'm really hoping that we don't have any wildfire smoke.
Ooh.
And I'm really hoping that everybody enjoys their time here in Edmonton, and that, the ex anxieties of an organizer, that everything doesn't just blow up. And not literally,
Yes.
not
No.
literally, but
No. Let's
figuratively, right?
emphasize we mean figuratively there. Yeah, because I can imagine organizing all those mini symposia is quite the logistical nightmare.
I had no idea how much work organizing a conference would be. I really have new appreciation for this. So I think from now on, when I'm on the sending side of emails, I'm just going to be much more, understanding, I think. And
Yes,
it's a lot of
yes.
work.
But do you think that it's a role that you're glad that you took on?
Absolutely. Yes, I don't know if I would want to do this every year. I could see maybe doing it again someday, or maybe, turning my attention to smaller events too. Those are very useful. Yeah, but I'm definitely glad I did this. But you should ask me when it's over too, right?
I will hunt you down at the meeting and find
Okay.
out.
Okay, good.
So we're talking about like the most current aspects of your work, something that you're doing. So to backtrack, can you tell us more about what your path into mathematical biology was?
Oh yeah, it's a little strange, I think. So I went to university. I don't know, should I admit all of this
Do
on a
it.
recorded podcast? So actually, when I graduated high school, I had, only the basic remedial algebra I had ever taken. I didn't really care for math. And I went to university to study biology, and I was taking math, working my way up to calculus. That's right, working my way up to calculus, right? So the British and European and Canadian listeners are horrified right now. It was a necessity, right, to take math. And I left university for a few years. We won't go into why.
Okay.
But I grew up a little bit, and when I came back, I was really pragmatic, and I wanted a plan for everything, which I really recommend to any student, by the way. And I was mapping out the entire rest, every course, every semester, right until I graduated, and I wanted to do it as fast as possible. And biology actually was going to take me too long, I felt, because you have to take labs. I like working in a lab, fine, but I felt like the labs are kind of, they're not fair. They require about the same amount of work as a regular class, but you get like 1 credit hour for them. Anyway, they were going to make my degree take much longer, and I actually figured out that math, I could finish faster. That's it. I could just finish like a year earlier. And I'm like, I don't know, maybe I could do math. And the first class I took was ordinary differential equations. And that was the first math class that I absolutely loved because for the first time, I could think about science. It could be applied to science in a way that was so real. No more of these 300-year-old physics problems, right? I like calculus fine, you know. But you are kind of studying ancient. It feels a little ancient, right? So I absolutely loved ordinary differential equations. I was fortunate because I was going to school at the University of Utah, which has a really great math biology program. And so I learned that there was this thing called math biology. I'm like, what, I can do both of these things that I love. Sign me up. And my application was, let's just say, unusual. Actually, now that I've reviewed a lot of applications, I don't know how unusual it was. I felt that way at the time. The grades were, they were not great at the beginning, but when I went back, they were very good. So it was like a bit of two extremes. And so perhaps somebody needed to explain the file, right? Or someone needed to take a closer look. So I had a professor that just basically walked it upstairs to James Keener and said, you should take a second look at this student. And that's how I got into grad school. My plan was always to go to grad program in biology. I thought math bachelor's degree, like they'll take me in a biology grad program as long as I have, the prerequisites and stuff. But then I ended up switching over to a math grad program. So I guess the lesson maybe is to, be open to opportunities or to take a different path.
Yeah, I'm marveling over the fact that for you decided that the easy route to get through academia was going to be to switch from biology to mathematics.
I know. I don't know. I don't know what I was thinking, but it
Well, it
worked
worked out
out,
for
so.
you. Yeah. That's amazing. So, one of the things that I noticed looking at your CV is that you also have taken a very kind of winding route to get to where you are. So, you've jumped from one US state to another, you've spent time at the University of Oxford before finally landing in the University of Alberta. So, how is it that that happened?
Well, I think when I graduated 2010, just a couple of years before that, there was this big financial upheaval, right? That's the financial event that everybody has made movies about, right? And it took a couple of years, but it percolated through everything and really impacted academia. And so there was a huge shortage of jobs. And so the market was very tough for many years, and it was just exceptionally competitive. So I was very lucky. My first postdoc, I get to go work in Oxford. That was an amazing experience. As a, first generation college graduate moving from Salt Lake City, Utah, right? Oxford was a very memorable time. And then I got the opportunity to do a couple of more postdocs after that. So Ohio State was the Math Bioscience Institute when it still existed. It was a very special place too. Met some really amazing friends there. There were some really amazing postdocs that went through there, some of the stars of math biology today. One of them is going to be one of our plenary speaker, actually. So that was great. And then I went to UNC to work with Greg Forrest, who's one of the legends of math biology. And he's just such a fantastic mentor. And I think that he was able to help me to give me more attention, because in my previous postdocs, I was part of these big centers. I was like one of 15 postdocs. I was successful in the sense that I published papers and did a lot of research, But you know, there's soft skills too, right? We call it professional development now. I don't know if that was really on people's radar. People were doing it, but maybe they didn't call it that. So Greg Forrest, in addition, you know, to getting me involved in amazing research, was able to help me in with those soft skills as well.
Yeah, I think there was this period where science was the thing that you did just because it was the thing that drove you to do that work. And then at some point, it became truly professionalized. And that process, I think we've realized that you need that professional development to make sure that you can succeed within research because it's not just about going into a lab and doing experiments and writing a paper, right?
Yeah, that's right. We have a big focus on that here. One of the things I like about Alberta is we have like a group of researchers and we can combine forces, you know. We can do things like have professional development retreats. We can combine our group meetings together, and so we get feedback from multiple PIs on related research. And then the students too, you know, they get that support from a big group of graduate students and postdocs. So that's one of the reasons that I'm really happy I ended up here at the University of Alberta.
Nice. So I think that's a great introduction as to how your career trajectory has gone. So let's talk a little bit more specifically about your research. So anyone who goes to your website will see this really pretty animation of small colored particles moving all around the place. Now, I'm going to assume that this is a kind of a nice visual depiction of your work. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, okay, so I can tell you I focus on random motion on micrometer scale, so random motion on the scale of like molecules and cells. So this animation that you mentioned, so we do a lot of data visualization in our work, and many of us, I think, are attracted to the more artistic aspects of data visualization. And while I don't have any artistic talent, my brother got all the artistic talent in the family. He's literally a designer, so you know, he kind of helps me and stuff. But I do like to, maybe in kind of a hobby sort of way, play around with these animations. So what I was inspired by at the time was this website. It was just beautiful. It's still up. You can see it. It's earth.null, NULL school, one word, .net. And it's a weather visualization. Just stunningly beautiful. And I just thought to myself, I want to figure out how it works and I want to make something like that. So it uses JavaScript, you know, the thing that works in your web browser. And I didn't really know at the time anything about it and how powerful it actually was for doing animations. And the animation that you're talking about, it just lives on my website. I mean, it's not like I could put it in a paper or do really anything else with it, but the experience did teach me how to maybe improve my presentations a little bit. So actually I do my presentations in JavaScript, and I have ever since then. So I can put these in animations in my presentations, and I do that for, you know, coursework and for, you know, research talks as well. Yeah. If you click on this thing on my website, I have a whole bunch of these little animations. You used to be able to see them, but the site that hosted them went down long time ago. So now it just diverts you over to GitHub.
Oh, boo.
But anyway, yeah, right. I need to do something to fix that.
Yeah, I will certainly go and play around with that later. And we'll put all of the links that you're talking about in the show notes so people can go and have a look at what inspired you to come up with that in the first place. I've just realized now I didn't ask you one of my usual questions, which is, can you describe your research in 60 seconds or less?
I can try. Okay, so I study motion and micron scale living systems. And one of the things about the micron scale, the scale of a single cell, is that the rules are different. I mean, it's not like quantum, like Ant-Man, you know, it's not the quantum realm, but it is the micron realm. And what makes it different from what we're used to is that thermal fluctuations, we call them molecules, flinging around like in a gas or a liquid. And what it does is it makes motion random. And the classic example is Brownian motion, which is, you know, a phenomenon that dates back to what, like 1850, around there, the famous problem that Einstein solved in 1905. And somehow all of these different mathematical areas and physics biology, they all kind of converged in this amazing story to solve this weird problem of a seed moving around in a microscope in this really erratic and random way. So in my research, I use stochastic processes to describe systems where elements are moving randomly and to try to figure out how they function despite or because of these random influences.
Very neat. So when I was looking through your publications, I got very excited because I saw one that looks at potassium channels, and this was for two reasons. So firstly, when I learned about action potentials in high school, this was essentially the thing that inspired me to go and do scientific research.
Cool.
And the other thing is that I spent my PhD studying a very specific type of potassium channel.
Okay.
And what's really funny about these things is that obviously, as a high school student, what I learned was, oh, you have these electrical signals within nerve cells, and you have these little pores in the membrane called ion channels. And as they allow a big amount of sodium or a positive charge to go in, they create this positive signal. And then this is what kind of transmits the information. And eventually, you have a different channel that opens up that allow potassiums to move out and the cell goes negative again. And so you have this very firm idea in your head that these are things that open and close very specifically in response to a very specific thing. And
Right.
then I went to a department where one of the other professors in the department is called David Colquhoun, and he does an awful lot of modeling of the opening and closing of these channels. And you realize there are like nine states that this channel is going through. And I think the paper that you have on the website that caught my attention is really cool in the sense that it's talking about, as you mentioned, like you've got these particles that move around randomly. And weirdly, like you can have action potentials that occur spontaneously
Right.
just as a result of these channels opening, right?
That's right. Yeah. Modeling sometimes is about simplification, right? So you mentioned the nine states, but in this particular study, we just modeled them as switches that turn on and off randomly, but in response to how much voltage the nerve cell is feeling across its membrane. For a long time, I mean, we've known about spontaneous action potentials, that the thermal noise can just randomly, rarely, but randomly can cause the channels to either open or close, whatever it is they need to do, and kick off, an action potential at random. They're not supposed to do that, right? Action potentials are supposed to be, you're associating red with apple, right? So it's interesting to know what the sources of noise at the network level are, right? The action potentials that are random and spontaneous are noise that would, I don't know, prevent things from working well at the network level, right? That's maybe a question. But for a long time, people thought that the initiation was driven by the sodium channels, right? Because in our modeling picture, this goes back to Hodgkin and Huxley, the sodium channels are fast and they're the thing that kicks off the action potential, right? And then, like you were saying, you get this slower sort of recovery back to the baseline that's governed by the slower potassium channels. But what the study, the conclusion was that because these channels are slower, their noise has a bigger effect. So when a potassium channel turns on or off, whatever it is it's doing, it lasts longer, right? So it's like this rare thing that happens maybe, but its effect is felt for a larger amount of time. And so it's actually these potassium channels that are far more likely to kick off spontaneous action potentials.
That's so interesting. It makes perfect sense, but it's not something I'd considered, even though. So, the reason why I was studying these potassium channels was as a way to produce new kind of analgesics, so painkillers. And the idea was to do that by amplifying or being able to open these channels and have them, as you say, return to that baseline more quickly or make that more likely. So, yeah, that's really interesting perspective. Not to kind of harp on about potassium channels, because looking through the other publications, it seems like the kind of work that you do spans all sorts of research topics. As you said, you're talking about at the micron level, you're looking at cells and molecules. Can you tell us more about some of the other things that you study?
So One of the things that I studied recently was how airway virus penetrates our mucus barrier, or what our natural defenses against that are, and how they work. So, I mean, we've known for a long time that antibodies are present in airway mucus and that they cover up epitopes, prevent virus from entering the epithelial layer. But one of the things that my collaborator, Sam Lai, discovered was that these antibodies actually arrest random motion. So this random motion of virus coming from the air or from a droplet, however it's being, you know, transmitted into your lungs, it reaches the mucus layer, and then it has to do Brownian motion before it can reach the epithelial layer and kick off the infection. And that takes some amount of time, right? Depending on how thick the mucus layer is. But viruses are small. And so small things diffuse faster. So they have like 10 minutes. They're across. So mucus, from that point of view, offers no barrier, no defense against virus. Bacteria, yes. Because mucus is this polymer gel, it's why, you know, mucus is gross and goofy. Mm-hmm. Right, there are these long polymers, chains of molecules that live in mucus, and they, bacteria are so big that they get wrapped up in these and they can't move. And then mucus is cleared, the cilia in your lungs, they keep treadmilling it out of your lungs, and so it gets trapped and then it gets removed. Right? So it just stops bacteria from being able to cause problems. But virus, how does that work? So then we have a mechanism for how many antibodies can anchor a virus actually to the polymers in these mucin polymers that are in mucus. So it's another way for antibodies to stop infection. There are many different lines of defense. That's what I learned, I think, you know. And I think we all learned that in the pandemic, that the immune system is so bewildered and complicated. There are so many parts to it that can all be very effective at what? At preventing the infection from ever starting, or in just making it not as severe, right? Clearing it faster.
Cool. So those are some great examples of the research that you do. But for the hardcore modeling nerds in our audience, and I'm going to admit that I have no expectation of understanding what you're going to say at this point, but can you talk to us more about the type of models that you use?
Okay, so I guess maybe I want to answer this as lots of people in biology use stochastic models. In fact, I think that it's widely appreciated. It's probably the fundamental mathematical language to really understand biology in, because there's so much information that we don't know in a biological system, and randomness is a good model for information that we don't have, or systems where we don't know everything. So there's another way to describe the models, or the way that I was trained at the University of Utah. My PhD advisor, Paul Breslov, this comes from maybe a physics tradition, and that toy models, simple models that ludicrously oversimplify the true biology, they all do, right? That's our counter argument. Have 10,000 parameters, fine, but you're still vastly oversimplifying. So where, and this is the debate that really gets people fighting. Like, where do you draw the line? Do you start simple, go complicated? Do you start complicated and maybe simplify? So the tradition that I like is to start simple, right? And maybe make it more complicated and learn along the way, gain insight into how things work. Because at the end of the day, we're trying to figure out how the world works. It's important to remember what the goal is there. I mean, there are math biologists that try to, you know, quantify things to develop therapies. There are many different kinds of goals. Just personally, for my research, it's mostly driven by trying to figure out how the world works.
Very cool. And specifically in terms of the mathematical models that you use, what types of equations?
So, yeah, we study like what we would call Chaminade-Kolmogorov equations. These describe stochastic processes. And this takes the form of typically high-dimensional linear partial differential equations. And these would be in the context of a cell. Cells have very complicated geometries. You know, they have internal membranes, endoplasmic reticulum, outer membranes. The shape of cells are very bizarre and variable. Neurons, they fill up a lot of space by creating these large branch networks. And so these geometries are very important in function, and they make the PDEs very difficult to solve. And one of the really successful foundations of math biology is dynamical systems, because it's like the language of qualitatively describing how things change with time, right? And we would like to be able to borrow all these amazing concepts from dynamical systems and stochastic processes, but not all of them are generalizable. For example, what are the critical points? What's the steady state behavior of your dynamical system? If studying neuronal action potentials, maybe it's a limit cycle oscillation, right? What does that mean in the stochastic setting? So the notions of dynamical systems kind of have to change a little bit. So one of them is something called first passage time. It's the way to describe how long something takes to happen. And that's really uniquely a stochastic definition. And so you can take the Chan-McCormick-Gaurav PDEs and you can integrate them, whatever that means, right? It means doing a whole bunch of analysis to even get down to these equations that I actually solve. And these are more tractable, usually, than the full Chan-McCormick-Gaurav equation. And you can make headway, you can do analysis and ultimately gain insight. I also like working with, I guess everybody likes to do data science these days, right? There's all these amazing tools that have been developed. And I think that if you're trained to understand stochastic processes, then you're in such a fortunate position, because all these statistical tools, they're described probabilistically. And even the neural networks, a lot of the generative neural networks, they use stochastic processes. And you're just poised right there. You're able to really to understand and use these things without the years and years of training that would ordinarily be necessary, right? So I get criticized sometimes when I go and I give a talk in a math department. There's expectations, right,
mm-hmm.
of what math is. And if you're not math, then maybe you're an engineer or something, which I always feel, is that an insult? I don't know. Engineers are pretty great too. But it's always interesting to see what is it that people were expecting, because they don't say that. Oftentimes it's a PD. Got to have a partial differential equation somewhere, right? But, you know, if you're doing Bayesian statistics, you could write one down, but, you know, you're doing these really complicated integrals maybe, right? Or you're constructing a generative model and you're trying to sample it, or maybe approximate a posterior distribution, right? There's no PDEs there. But maybe probability is the mathematical framework that ties it all together.
Very interesting. So before we depart, Jay, I'd like for the audience to get to hear about you outside of the workplace. So I have a couple of quickfire questions for you so people can get to know you.
Okay.
If you're ready for them.
Okay, fire away. I'm scared, but let's...
Oh, don't be scared.
Okay.
So what's your favorite kind of winter meal? Not to stereotype Canadians and it being incredibly cold up there.
Oh, now I'm going to be a bad Canadian, because I consider myself Canadian now, but I was born in the United States. But my favorite winter meal is gumbo, and that's from New Orleans, right? But it's just such a perfect Canadian meal, and maybe Canadians would talk about poutine, and I have a local restaurant here that makes gumbatine.
Oh, interesting.
Which is poutine with gumbo. It's absolutely perfect marriage. It's a perfect mashup, right? And it's pretty great. So gumbo is my answer.
Very good. Yeah, from about as far south as you can get in the US.
That's right. That's right.
So my next question is, what was your last Netflix or let's say whatever streaming service binge?
Wow. So right now I'm watching Stick, which is a funny golf show. I guess the last one I finished maybe was the new season of Black Mirror. That was pretty good. Yeah.
I found that I watched the first episode and I'm like, I'm going to lose the will to live after watching this. Is it worth carrying on?
I love Black Mirror. And if you're not a little bit disturbed by the end of it's, if it's not a mashup of feelings, like vaguely disturbed, really fascinated, you know, kicks off your imagination, that's a Black Mirror episode. Yeah, and they definitely hit it out of the park with the one with Rashida Jones. I was thinking about that for days. Just absolutely disturbing. It's a really great show. Of course, I wish they made it more often, right? It's like every 5 years it seems like they come out with a new season. But yeah, this high quality. I don't want a crappy season of Black Mirror either, right?
For sure. I wonder how much of that is actually them having to try and kind of go beyond what's happening in the real world for it to be shocking, because at this point, it just seems so much of this is already happening that for it them to fictionalize it is a job. So the last one is a very silly one for you. What three things would you do if you're invisible?
What three things? Invisible.
Yes. Without being creepy. That's the thing.
I guess, of course, right? I guess I would probably end up playing pranks on my friends. That's probably what I would end up doing.
Yeah, I think just like jump scare type stuff is probably.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's right. Or move stuff around. I don't know.
Yes. Yeah. Be a poltergeist.
Yeah, there you go.
On that note, thank you so much for your time today, Jay. It's been a really fun conversation, and I think it's been a worthy conclusion to season two of Biology in Numbers. As I said, I hope to run into you at some point in Edmonton. That'd be really nice. And I wish you and the rest of the organisers the best of luck with the meeting.
All right, thanks, Parmpir.
You've been listening to Biology in Numbers, a podcast from the Society for Mathematical Biology and produced by me, Parmveer Bahia, at Arts Science Media. You can learn more about SMB on their website, smb.org, and via social media on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Find links to all of these and some for today's guest in the episode show notes. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, and very likely your favorite podcast platform. So show us some love by making sure you review and subscribe. Ah, great, great. So now my hotspot's not doing very well either. Let me check if my router's working. No, of course it isn't. So we're just going to have to suck it up, unfortunately. I have very unkind words for Frontier right now.